Welcome to Journalism History, a podcast that rips out the pages of your history books to re-examine the stories you thought you knew and the ones you were never told. I'm your host, Nick Hershon, guiding you through your own drafts of history. This episode is sponsored by the Media Department at Duquesne University. Located in the heart of Pittsburgh, the Media Department uses technology, critical thinking, and artistic expression to turn students into storytellers, designers, video producers, and visual communicators who engage the public in innovative ways today and tomorrow. She was a pilot whose daring adventures soared off the funny pages. Jenny Dare flew to fame during World War II as the heroine of a newspaper comic strip named Flying Jenny, a culturally significant character who eased American minds about the shifting roles of women in wartime. In this episode, we discuss Flying Jenny with Pamela Walk of Duquesne University and Ashley Walter of Penn State University, who have chronicled the pioneering character in an article for the winter 2018 issue of Journalism History. We explore how Flying Jenny became a role model for assertive women, even as she had to put up with male pilots calling her honey. All right, so Pam and Ashley, welcome to the Journalism History Podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. We're really excited to be here.
So we're here today to talk about your forthcoming article in Journalism History, and the title is Soaring Out of the Private Sphere, How Flying Jenny in Comics Helped Pioneer a New Path for Women's Work During World War II. So the first question for you, Pam, I understand that you had discovered this topic. How did you first hear about Flying Jenny, and why did you find her interesting enough that you wanted to research her?
Yeah, so basically I was working on my dissertation and I was looking at press coverage during World War II. And so as a result, I was going through many, many microfilms and digital archives looking at different coverage with newspapers in the U.S. And so in the process of going through the Boston Globe, I ended up somehow on the comic strip pages at one point trying to look for a different section of the newspaper. And there she was. And I was just like, what is this? This is really, really interesting. And so I remember downloading the PDF of that particular page. And I may have gone down a rabbit trail at some point, you know, trying to figure out a little bit more about her, but realized that I had to kind of finish my dissertation. That was sort of important. And so I, so I just kind of tucked this away and thought, man, I hope I can get back to it because I'm really intrigued by this. And so fast forward almost a year, I was starting out my first year at Duquesne as an assistant professor, and Ashley was assigned to me as a grad assistant. And so I basically was like, okay, this is what we're going to do. And so I had her basically go through the Boston Globe and pull all the Flying Jenny Sunday comic strips. And we started diving in. And the more we started reading, the more we started realizing that she was actually quite an exemplar in terms of how women were portrayed in the comics and just in general during that time period.
All right. So I'd like to ask you guys about the creator of this comic strip, Russell Keaton. I understand he also drew for other comic strips, including Buck Rogers and Sky Road. So Ashley, I'll give this one to you. What can you tell us about Russell Keaton and what inspired him to create Flying Jenny?
So Russell Keaton, he was inspired by his wife and his daughter. So he wanted to create this really strong character. He also was extremely into aviation and his other, some of his prior work also deals with aviation. And so he created Flying Jenny in the image of his very young daughter and his wife. So he gave Jenny his daughter's blonde hair. And then he said he gave Jenny's beautiful features and fearlessness that reflected his wife, whose name was Virginia. But at the time, Jenny was a popular nickname. So he actually named the character after his wife.
And can you describe Flying Jenny, the character? What are some of her characteristics? What does she do, et cetera?
Yeah, so she is a rather fearless woman who is just obsessed with flying. She is in a very kind of stereotypical pinup-esque. She has perfectly coiffed blonde hair, always, you know, perfect makeup and lipstick, is very thin and voluptuous and beautiful, frankly. She has a lot of admirers, which makes also for a very fun comic strip, too. There's an element of danger and of love. And she, flying is her biggest passion.
And I understand that Jenny's arch nemesis in the strip is a character named Spinner Martin, which is a really cool comic strip sort of name. This rotund, gruff flyer who despises the idea of quote-unquote lipstick pilots. So, Pam, can you tell us a little bit about who Spinner Martin is in the strip?
Yeah, Spinner is pretty much the typical bad guy, right? Like, he tries to beat her at different races and events, and he loses. And so then he's like, well, I'm not beyond cheating to try to beat her. Throughout early 1942, the comic strip on the Sunday side was pretty focused in on these two pilots. So you had Jenny in one plane and Spinner in another, and they both were flying for different companies that were trying to win the naval test pilot to have the Navy contract with their companies to produce these planes. And so it was actually really fascinating because of Keaton's, you know, interest in aviation, and he was a pilot himself. So he really kind of took his readers through every little step that pilots and plane manufacturers had to go through in order to win military contracts to produce these planes on the behalf of the United States. And so in 42, Spinner is doing everything he can to beat her in the skies. And when that doesn't work, he starts trying to set her up and frame her to make it look like he's trying to that she is trying to sabotage his plane. Her sidekick, Cyril Redmond, kind of reveals this conspiracy and saves the day. And Jenny goes on to win the test trials despite that. And I believe Spinner gets locked up because he was trying to cheat on a federal contract.
Mm. And so to talk about the groundbreaking nature of this strip, so you explain in the article, women were already flying long before flying. Jenny debuted in 1939, and you mentioned that Amelia Earhart took her first flying lesson in 1921 and bought her first aircraft just 6 months later. So women taking flight was not necessarily a new concept, even though it wasn't maybe predominant in society yet. But can you give us an idea a little bit what was different about flying Jenny in this case?
Yeah, I think that it just kind of maybe made it a little bit more visual element in terms of women in the skies. So, you know, during World War II, and our article doesn't really go into this, but a lot of women were clamoring to fly on behalf of the government. And our article does actually talk a little bit about how there were two different efforts to try to permit women to fly planes and to assist with getting planes from the manufacturing plant to the combat field. And throughout 42, basically the, you know, Senate and Congress was saying, no, it's too dangerous for women. We can't have them doing that. But then as the war started ramping up, you start seeing the government actually approve authorizing the women's auxiliary for the army, the WACS and the WAVES. And so you start seeing women taking more non-traditional jobs and doing things on behalf of the military in an effort to free up every able-bodied man so that he can go into combat. And so I think with the comic strip, one of the things that we see is just, you know, it's, you know, by 43, it's not just Jenny, it's her, she has an entire crew of women who have joined her, and they're all working to help the government in terms of flying. So I think that it just sort of is an example of how there were many women in the country who were eager to fly on behalf of the government, but the times were just not conducive for it like they are today.
Because you were coming into this when you're a master's student, it's maybe one of your first historical research projects. So what did you find interesting about that?
So this was my first take at research. And it was really exciting for me. I did a lot of digging in the comic sections, which as a first research assignment is pretty fun. And it wasn't, you know, it was kind of difficult to find these pages. So I ended up sometimes going down rabbit holes of other comic strips. But it was really exciting because I went in to this, it was my first semester graduate master's program, knowing that I wanted to do some kind of work with women. I had no idea that I would like journalism history so much. And so it was really exciting when Pam asked me to do this project with her. I was very enticed by the kind of fearlessness, this rare fearlessness of women at the time. And I really learned a lot.
Yeah, it seems like these sorts of partnerships are so exciting because now the two of you obviously can present this together and maybe work on more things. I want to talk to you guys about that later on. But just getting into the method, because you mentioned this a little bit, Pam, for this study, it seems like you used 55 weekly installments of the Flying Jenny comic strip, published every Sunday in the Boston Globe from December 7th, 1941 through December 27th, 1942. And you explained that you picked Sunday, of course, because that edition would have reached the largest circulation, the largest potential number of readers. You focus on two main questions here. So I'll ask you both of them and I'll give each of you a chance to chime in here. So again, Ashley, just to go with you again, how did the plot of Flying Jenny reflect the conflict between traditional and non-traditional work of women during the first year of the U.S. involvement in World War II?
What's really interesting with Jenny is that she just completely, she will not stay inside. She wants to fly no matter what. And her movement in the kind of public sphere and the working sphere that traditionally was meant for men, especially with aviation, she was no matter what with, you know, Spinner calling her Blondie, people calling her, you know, lipstick pilot. She was constantly pushing against these gender norms to be not only a part of it, but to excel in the in this kind of male dominated world. And what's really interesting too, going back to the love line of it, you know, she is proposed to many times throughout the strip. She has, you know, different love interests and it's always one or the other, you know, there's marriage or there's flying, and she always constantly picks a career, which is, you know, very rare for 1942, I think is the first time she's proposed to.
Mm. Wow. And so it's interesting that even though they're presenting her as sort of an assertive woman and a role model, she is still facing the challenges of male attention, maybe unwanted male attention. And sometimes they're presenting her in ways that are more traditionally of what a woman should expect. So is she, you know, truly a role model there, or is it something where she's also just conforming to gender norms of the time?
I would say she definitely is a role model because she is, you know, she's making, she's excelling in this field and really pursuing her dreams. And I think that's what makes her a role model, is that no matter what, she has all these barriers of being framed by Spinner and, you know, maybe losing some love interest, but she really excels and it does what she loves. And you can tell she's very happy. But what's interesting too is, you know, with the pinup angle of this, is she's very beautiful and oftentimes is perceived, you know, as she's very attractive and desirable. And I think that also just fits in line with the era of, you know, trying to appeal to servicemen. And, you know, she couldn't be too radical because, you know, there's this kind of this push that women always have to be, remain beautiful. So if she's going to rebel against the system, at least, you know, she was playing along with gender norms in that way.
And I would add to that too, you know, when we look at the time period when this was happening, you know, I think it was in 42 that that Wonder Woman first came out. I know Jenny predates Wonder Woman. And but Wonder Woman and her creator kind of really was pushing this idea of just, you know, women feeling empowered to the point that they could offer something to contribute to the war effort, something that they could contribute to society beyond just the domestic sphere. And so I think that in a lot of ways, these comic strips and these other, media imagery, illustrations, Rosie the Riveter, images like that really helped create this new possibility for women who up until that point, unless they, because of economics, they were required to work outside the home, women generally weren't. So I think that it's actually a really fascinating time period in terms of women and the workplace.
And the second question that you raise in the study relates to the use of paper dolls. And Ashley kind of got into this a little bit in her response. You explained that these were common in newspaper comic sections throughout the 1940s. Readers were encouraged to cut out their favorite characters and keep them long after the newspaper was discarded. So how were the paper dolls of Jenny Dare used to kind of deflect the conflict between traditional and non-traditional women's work throughout 1942? And Pam, you can pick up on that one, then we'll let Ashley chime in.
Yeah, no. So basically what we discovered as we read through that first year of U.S. involvement in the war and the first year of, Flying Jenny strips during that time period, that whenever she had a storyline that was just really out of this world, you know, she is in the middle of the Navy test pilots and testing, and her plane's about to go down, and it looks like, you know, it's the end for Jenny. Or, she is flying off into the horizon with a new client for the company that manufactures planes. You know, these storylines that are just like really over the top, and her doing things that just women would not dream of doing. During those strips, it was like they would anchor them at the end with these paper dolls. And I mean, paper dolls have a long history in pop culture, and not just American culture. They originated in Europe, became popular in the US. But in some ways, we kind of looked at these paper dolls and the timing of them as like, you know, almost like it's okay for our audience to see her doing these wild and crazy things, if at the very end we can anchor it with a more traditional pinup style pose and dresses and cute outfits and, you know, all those things that kind of go back to that idea of like what American men were fighting for during the war years. So it's almost like, it's okay that she can do all this crazy stuff because at the end of the day, she's still this beautiful girl next door who likes to wear frilly dresses and look pretty.
And Ashley, anything you'd like to say about the use of the paper dolls of Jenny?
Yes, the paper dolls are just one of my favorite parts. And they, in the beginning of her strip, the paper dolls weren't used as much, and then very frequently toward the end of her storyline. And just my favorite one, which I think really shows she's doing something. I think she's fighting or doing some kind of secret mission against the Nazis, because it starts to get very heavy in World War II, her storyline does. And in her paper doll below that, she has a garden theme paper doll. It's a gardening dress, a gardening hat, gardening gloves, and a basket. And it's just the most frilly, ridiculous thing. And, you know, in the frames above, she's never, in her storyline, she's never, not often wearing dresses. She's usually in a, you know, a jumpsuit or something, and, you know, kind of like a work uniform. And so it just, the juxtaposition between those two things is just really, I think, really proves that point of what Pam was just saying.
And just as a tangent here on paper dolls, because I saw the two of you at the October meeting of the American Journalism Historians Association, where you were discussing some of this research. And it seems that a lot of people now may come up to you guys and talk about paper dolls, and they remember them from their own youth. It's something that is still, I guess, around a little bit, the American doll collection, but there's not so much of paper dolls appearing in newspapers, certainly is not a thing anymore. So have the two of you encountered this, a lot of people saying, oh, you make me nostalgic for my childhood, and I remember growing up with these and loving paper dolls?
Well, I mean, I think that the feedback that we got at the conference in October was more of, yes, there's something there. You're onto it. Keep digging. I think that there is definitely a nostalgia element to it. And since we've started looking at paper dolls as a whole, it's like you see them everywhere now. It's really remarkable. I think that it's also fascinating, too, because, you know, we're in such a high-tech world, but yet paper is such a, you know, temporary thing. And yet these paper dolls are popping up in, you know, boutiques and shops and stuff like that. It's just like you go wherever I go, I end up bumping into some sort of paper doll image. So it's kind of funny in that regard. But yeah, I think that it's interesting because in our current research, we were sort of digging around, and even with the Flying Jenny, you know, there's not been a lot of mass comm research looking at paper dolls. Most of that is more in, I guess, fashion history, and, you know, we've kind of had to borrow from other areas because there's not been a lot of research looking at it.
And what do you think makes the paper doll special or unique as something that's worthwhile to research, any different than the traditional newspaper, TV, radio, whatever we tend to see at these mass communication history conferences?
Well, I think that at least in the terms of paper dolls in the newspapers, what that is sort of hinting at is this idea that, you know, newspapers were looking for ways to relate to new readers. And so during the height of the popularity of comics, it's not surprising to me that they would have paper dolls, you know, in the Sunday newspaper section. And they were certainly trying to get people, you know, interested in the newspaper. It was astounding to me, when we started diving into this research that, you know, just the millions of people that would read the Sunday comic strip. And we saw editorials written, in the 1940s, by academics who were really outraged at this, you know, very vulgar form of popular culture. It was kind of amusing.
Why did they find it so vulgar with the paper dolls? Just the way that they were displayed. I mean, I saw in some of the photographs that are going to be running with your piece in Journalism History, you do see that, you know, you have Jenny Dare, the kind of juxtaposition, right, of her being presented in her aviation outfit. And then in the final frame, you do see her maybe in a bikini or kind of dressed down so that you could be dressed. So that's what people were taking exception to mostly.
No, I mean, I believe that back in the day, people were outraged by comics in general, showing women running around in essentially their underwear. In particular, I think that some of the criticism was directed toward Wonder Woman and some of the other comic strips that had women so scantily dressed. I don't know that that criticism was necessarily directed at paper dolls. I think that the paper dolls were probably people visioned or saw them as something that was generated and aiming toward younger readers, children. So I think that that necessarily wasn't offensive as much as just some of the superheroes that emerged in the comics during that time period and just how they presented themselves.
And also too, in some of the frames in Flying Jenny, when it becomes around 43, where it's almost an all female star cast in the plot, you know, when they have their powwows and they're talking, you know, one of the frames is of the women talking, but the essentially the camera lens is through a woman's legs. So you still kind of have this pinup style that's really pervasive throughout, you know, the photos or the artwork.
And it's, yeah, and it's interesting too, because I know, when I was in Savannah, back when I was a reporter, I had a friend whose husband is a graphic artist, and he was going to SCAD at the time, Savannah College of Art and Design. And one of the things that we would talk about was just like, you know, this idea that, you know, comic strips tend to put women in these really scanty outfits and, you know, kind of really playing into stereotypes and things like that. So it's interesting to me that, you know, even as early as the 40s, this was happening. You know, I think that the context of those discussions in Savannah were, you know, more modern comic strips, you know, the Marvel and stuff like that. But, you know, those criticisms of how women are portrayed obviously were still at the forefront of discussions back in the 40s when they first emerged as characters in the comics.
And you've been mentioning some of the other characters that we tend to associate with graphic artist depictions of women from this time period: Brenda Starr, Rosie the Riveter, Wonder Woman. Although Jenny Dare predated many of those female characters that we associate with the comic books and illustrations of the era, but those characters still occupy space in the public consciousness in a way that Jenny does not. So why do you think Jenny has been almost lost to time, in a sense, when some of those characters, for whatever reason, are still known by the public? And Ashley, we can start with you on that one.
I think, you know, she had a very short run in terms of, you know, especially Wonder Woman. Russell Keaton, her creator, he died very early from cancer. He was in his 30s. And so it had eventually been taken over by some other comic writers and artists. But when the war ended, and in one of her last strips, she even talks about the boys coming home, and she doesn't really have a place anymore in flying in the world of aviation. Her daring plot disappears along with the war.
Yeah, I would agree. And I do think that, you know, because her creator wasn't around, I think that perhaps played a big part of it. It seems that maybe I think it was in the early to mid 90s, some of his artwork was rediscovered. I know we had found a book that was sort of a compilation of Russell Keaton's artwork exclusively with Flying Jenny. And so, I mean, I think that for in graphic illustration circles, it's probably a little bit more acknowledged, but just in the general public, because, you know, she didn't last past the war, it just kind of was forgotten.
Mm. Well, that's where you guys step in, right? And why it's important for your research to come out. And usually at the end of a journal article, we'll talk about opportunities for future research. You've discussed it a little bit with the need for paper dolls research, but anything else that you saw while researching Jenny that you feel maybe is your next project, or just something else that you think scholars should be doing?
Well, I mean, I would say that there is maybe more research to be done looking at comics and just how different people groups are portrayed and how that plays into stereotypes. I think that, you know, because comics are, you know, kind of looked at more as like a pop culture, not a high culture type of thing, you know, maybe they've been slighted in the past, but, you know, they certainly are still making lots of money at the box office. So I think that American infatuation with superheroes and comics and things like that, you know, is still alive and well. I think that also with comics in particular, it's interesting because, you know, they say something about the era that they emerge in terms of, you know, why people turn to comics and comic heroes in certain times of uncertainty. And I often think about, just in my own, you know, ponderings, you know, how is it that there are like 5 million Superman or Spider-Man movies? Now, I'm exaggerating because there's not that many, really. But it just seems like every time you turn around, there's like a new Spider-Man origin story. And I'm just like, haven't we covered that already? But on the flip side, you know, I think that there is some truth to the fact that when you live in uncertain times, you look to, you know, some of these histories and these stories of heroes in a way that, you know, kind of help make sense of, you know, just what's happening in the headlines. And we certainly saw that, you know, with Flying Jenny in the 1940s, because there was a lot going on and there was a lot of uncertainty. And I think that the comic strips and seeing women doing things that weren't necessarily social norms at the time definitely helped reassure people that it was okay. Everything was going to be okay. And I think sometimes we just need to hear that.
Is that your sense too, Ashley, of what we should be doing in the future, what you would encourage other mass communication scholars to look into?
Yeah, I think that's really important. One thing to piggyback off of, I think it'd be really interesting to look at kind of racial and ethnic dynamics happening there too, because there is a little bit of that in Flying Jenny, but what when there is, you know, kind of a different nationality, it's often derogatory. But then there's also portrayals of, there's one woman from Mexico on her flying crew that's, you know, daring and fearless, just like Jenny. So I do think that there's something interesting there to see, you know, how that played in its time.
Yeah, and another kind of off topic a little bit, but I think is really interesting, and I've only just begun to kind of scrape the surface on this with some research with the Pittsburgh Courier, though, is, you know, in the Black press, there's a lot of comics as well. There's editorial comics, and there was a series of historical pieces that were done by various illustrators that kind of were in a Black pride sort of sense. So sort of like kind of giving readers images and backstories, origin stories of different men and women, people of color who did remarkable things. And it was all presented to readers in illustration form. So I think that, you know, from the historical perspective, what I've learned from this is that, you know, you can't poo-poo the pop culture, because, you know, growing up, I'm not going to lie, I used to make fun of my brothers for all the comic books that they used to read. And they think it's kind of funny now that I ended up doing research on comics, considering I gave them a lot of sibling grief growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, something that captures the American imagination in such a way, as you say, Captain America, Spider-Man, all of the Avengers are very popular right now. So there's still something that is very important to the public that they take some satisfaction in, escapism maybe in. So we should be researching those sorts of topics. That's what people are paying attention to. One just final thing that I wanted to ask both of you about is obviously the nature of your partnership, because we described how Ashley was a master's student at Duquesne when Pam was starting there as an assistant professor. So Pam, if you could just start out, and I'll ask Ashley about it on the other end. But for you, Pam, what do you think is important about being a mentor in this journalism history process when you're introducing somebody to research and to a different subject that maybe you're excited about and you want to kind of stoke that passion in them? So how do you approach that sort of thing, and how'd you do it with Ashley?
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, I think that one of the biggest motivations for me in mentoring scholars is just the fact that I have had so many generous mentors over my years, both in my graduate program at Point Park University in Pittsburgh and then at Ohio University at the Scripps School of Journalism. And so, you know, having had other scholars, established scholars, kind of guide and direct me, it was important to me to be able to hopefully, you know, repeat that and pass it, you know, pay it forward. So I feel really fortunate because, you know, I had no idea whether Ashley would even be remotely interested in what I was interested in. And I know that when when her cohort first came in, my chair at the time had mentioned that she was interested in women's studies. And so he was hoping that this might be helpful for me. And it was a really wonderful partnership because while Ashley, you know, she had mentioned this was her first time doing academic research of this nature, you know, I had done plenty of it during my doctoral work. So like I was prepared for that, but I was off in World War II land. So I wasn't really looking at women and women's studies. I never took any, you know, classes on women and feminism or any of that stuff. And so that was sort of like my weak spot. And fortunately, as we were going through this process, you know, Ashley had that background and was, you know, giving me, you know, I saw this and I think this might be something that we can talk about. And it was really, it turned into be a wonderful partnership because we both had different strengths. And, you know, when we put them together, it worked out in a really fantastic way.
So yeah, for you, Ashley, on the other side of that, what was it like to partner with Pam and to have her as a mentor on your first major research project?
I love gushing about Pam because it is so wonderful. I went into this master's program thinking, oh, I really want to teach. I can't wait to do that. And she pulled me into this research project and I really just fell in love with it. And I never thought journalism history was going to be the kind of path I wanted to go down. And when I was applying for doctoral programs, I was, you know, keeping an open mind. But at the end of the day, when I thought about the questions I had and the research I wanted to do, it kept always going back to journalism history. And I really attribute that to Pam, both showing me how to do it and how to foster an appreciation for it. And she just was really wonderful along the way. If I had an idea, even if they were duds, she was always really encouraging and always gently pushed me in the right direction and just really taught me so much.
Thank you. Sounds like that's a partnership that we can expect to see maybe more in the pages of journalism history. Are you two going to be collaborating on anything else in the future, you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So. Yeah, mm-hmm. We have some plans for some paper dolls and creating some oral histories. So I'm really excited about that. I think the big trick now is working around Ashley's busy doc studies program because I remember what that was like.
Help.
but it's been fun, and I'm looking forward to the future research that we do. I don't know what all it will be, but I am very, very thankful that I've found a kindred spirit when it comes to some of this stuff.
Yeah, me too. Oh, shucks.
I know. And I didn't pay you to say any of that, so.
Well, thank you, guys. It's very clear you both are really excited about this project. You're passionate, and you have an affinity for working with each other, so it was really great to talk to you. Thank you guys for coming on.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much for tuning in. An additional thanks to our sponsor, the Media Department at Duquesne University. Until next time, I'm your host, Nick Hirshon, signing off with the words of Edward R. Murrow. Good night and good luck.